Hey everybody, how's it going? I'm Steve.
I'm Frank.
And you're listening to Zotcast. It's a special edition.
Yep, special edition Zotcast Rant of the Rings, Part 1, Fellowship of the Rant.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're kind of down a few people.
Well, that's how it started too, you know. It starts off as a couple of hobbits, then hopefully more would join them later. So we're hoping to get my sister to come back in one of these episodes. She just wasn't feeling up to it tonight, unfortunately.
Frank's been needing to get this rant, like this three-part rant, off his chest
for the longest time.
Yes, yes.
Many ages of the earth have passed.
Like every time I go online, he's like, "Hey, want to do Zotcast? Want to do Zotcast? You ready? You ready? Want to do Zotcast?" I'm like,
"Can we please do this? Can I get this portion of my life over with so I can finally move on?
I want to close this heavily worded ranted chapter."
I have to bury the pain once and for all.
So, Frank, tell us, what is The Lord of the Rings about?
The Lord of the Rings is a classic adventure story written by Professor J.R.R. Tolkien. It was a sequel, a very unexpected sequel to The Hobbit, which of course is what really catapulted him to fame.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Everybody was like clamoring for a sequel to The Hobbit because it was such a fun little children's story. 13 years later, he comes up with an entirely different story, and it just blew people's minds, and some people would say it changed the world.
I like to think that it did. Gordo and I mentioned this like back when we were teenagers. We were talking about Dungeons and Dragons, and he mentioned that The Hobbit pretty much started the like fantasy genre almost.
Yeah, that's what. Well, there wasn't fantasy genre like that before. It set a new trend.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, like before then, shit. What kind of fantasy shit did they have like back in the 30s and 40s and 50s? Like,
I think they just had
jungle adventurer stories.
Yeah, exactly. And you had Frankenstein and you had like Dracula. Yeah. Like that shit was written like well before that.
Well, those were like 1800s.
Oh yeah.
But
what? Tolkien was born in the 1800s.
But I'm saying like fantasy, stories about elves and dwarves and things. That would be, most people would have considered that like, kid stuff.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's why Tolkien himself, his elves and dwarves, he changed the way they were spelled. Because traditionally, elf, and elf plural is elfs, and dwarfs is, with an F, dwarfs. But he changed it to elves and dwarves because he thought, the sound gave the races more dignity, made the races sound more dignified.
Yeah, real
thing.
Just like knife and knives.
No, that's actual proper pronunciation.
Yeah, but he was English, though, wasn't he?
He made his elves and dwarves to be spelled like that because he felt that making the name spelled like that gave the species more dignity.
Yeah, okay.
Like, a real species of elves wouldn't call themselves elves.
What about a gnome?
We're such a dick. So, anyway, Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
The second highest-selling book of the 20th century,
ooh,
right after the Bible.
Oh,
Lord
yeah.
of the Rings is the greatest book of fiction, acknowledged fiction, in the world. And naturally, many attempts were made over the years to turn it into a movie. There were animated features, which were pretty decent for the time. And then finally, in 2001, Peter Jackson and Weta Films with New Line Cinema produced a trilogy of Lord of the Rings movies. And these movies have become the bane of my existence because I love the book so much, and these movies have almost nothing to do with the books apart from superficial events and characters. Like, yes, there is a hobbit named Frodo. Is he like the same Frodo in the book? Not a bit.
In this podcast, we are just going to cover the Fellowship, right?
Yes, this first episode is just going to be about the first movie, Fellowship of the Ring.
I know, it's kind of hard to get into it without referencing the other two movies.
Yeah, well, what I intended to do is, when I watched the movies recently, in preparation for this, I opened up a Word pad on my computer, and I just took notes on observations about things that had been changed between the book to the movie. Things that, in my opinion, should not have been changed, or at least should have been changed differently, extremely differently. So I'm going to go through my notes point by point. I'm going to read out the note I wrote, then I'm going to expand on that point and explain myself. And I'm going to be drinking coffee, and Steve's going to be here to be Steve, steving like a fiend.
I am currently drinking the coffee as well. Yes, and see, from Frank's perspective, this is, again, like as he said, he is going to be looking at this from the perspective of someone who's read the books.
And I love the book.
And have watched the films.
More than any other book I've ever read in my life. I've lost count of how many times I've read Lord of the Rings. I'm actually currently reading Book of Lost Tales. And before that, I was reading the Unfinished Tales. So I am a hardcore Tolkien fanatic. Okay, I wouldn't say I'm that far, but I'm very passionate about Tolkien's work. I enjoy reading the world that he created.
Yep, and Frank, for
and
this
I
kind
just
of...
eat it up, yeah.
Yeah, you could pretty much recall, you know, certain information that would help you in reviewing the in our discussion. Whereas I, just being a casual reader, I've only read, like, the first three chapters in The Fellowship of the Ring because, you know, I'm a very poor nerd. Like, I'm a poor excuse for a nerd, and I've watched the films quite a few times each. You know, I just like reading it for the entertainment, so that's my perspective.
So you can take the movie for its own value, and you're free of...
bias.
Yes. You don't have a bias, the bias that I'm stuck under from loving the book so much,
mm-hmm.
and seeing how badly it was portrayed and how badly it was twisted changed from everything that made it great.
I like to hear this from you. So you go right ahead.
Okay, so mind you all, this is the extended DVD edition of the book. Mm-hmm. I figure if you're going to hate something, hate it completely.
Hate it for all the stuff they don't even bother to put into the original theatrical release.
Yep. Hate it for everything. Nothing will be forgiven, ever. Okay, so. Prologue is passable and mostly accurate. Yes, it was hard for them to fuck this up. It is the core exposition of the entire plot. There is nothing there that needed to be changed that they could have changed. And I had no complaints with the prologue. It told the salient points. It showed you which of the elves, you know, got the three rings, although they never actually named Curdan. It's like, there's Elrond, there's Galadriel, who's that guy?
Yeah. I never really thought of that until now, thank you.
Yeah, that is that third guy is Curdan, the shipwright of the elves.
Mm-hmm.
Who in turn gave Gandalf the Red Ring when Gandalf first arrived in Middle-earth out of the West.
I was going to say, I don't recognize him having a ring. I don't remember him having a ring.
No, he never wore it openly.
Okay.
But it was the Red Ring which kindled the hearts of all.
What does that mean?
It kindles people's hearts. It gives them hope and inspiration. And that was Gandalf's role. He was a counselor and a guide and a teacher.
Just like, you know, with the wisdom that he imbued into Frodo.
Exactly, exactly.
That insight was, in the Mines of Moria.
Yeah, that was Gandalf's greatest attribute, was his wisdom and his kindness. I mean, and when you read Unfinished Tales, there is a whole chapter in there about the wizards. And it talks about the two unnamed blue wizards who went into the East and never came back. It talks about the origin of the wizards, how they were hand-picked by the Eldar, or not the Eldar, like some of the gods. They were literally hand-picked by the gods of the elves to come to Middle-earth to be a counter to Sauron.
Oh, wow. Well,
yeah.
I mean, I was talking to Fred at one point about this. And he mentioned that among them was Gandalf. But Gandalf was called, like, something else, like Odin or something. I don't remember.
Olorin.
Alora is the A. See, I knew it began with an O.
Yeah.
At the time, but he was, like, much younger. But I think, wasn't that, like, after the First Age, after Morgoth?
They first appeared at the beginning of the Third Age.
Okay.
They came separately. Saruman came first, then came Radagast, then the Blue Wizards, and Gandalf came last. And Curdan perceived that Gandalf was the greatest of all, which is why he gave Gandalf the Red Ring, saying, "You will need this, for you will have sore trials ahead," or something like that. So Curdan foresaw that Gandalf would have a long road before, you know, he could finally go to his rest, and that he would need the ring. So he bestowed it where he thought best, because in his hand at the Havens, it was doing nothing for the world.
Yeah, because it wasn't. It was apart from the world.
Well, not. It was. They were all supposed to be hidden, but you know, what can the Red Ring of Fire do at the Havens, where he's just building ships for the elves to leave Middle Earth? You know, it's wasted there, and the rings need to be active in the world to be good. So, anyway, we really strayed from the prologue.
We started getting into like the extra tidbits that have nothing to do. Well, that aren't part of the film itself.
Yeah.
But they do kind of explain some of the stuff that is in the film that never truly gets explained because it's not the book.
I'm not going to nitpick that far and say, well, they should have pointed out that Curdan received the ring, and because then they have to explain all that other shit about Gandalf. And
yeah, like they never.
The thing is already three hours, almost 20 minutes long. You know, we don't need that much padding.
And we're already into like. I don't know, 15 to 20 minutes into the podcast.
We're still talking about the prologue. Okay, we get a... So, next note here. Sauron looks a little too badass, comes off as silly. And it's true. The guy is a fucking monster. about Frankenstein.
Yeah, yeah. Like, in the prologue, they show him, like, he takes one swing... And yeah, he knocks over, like, 25 people.
Yeah, he's, like, 9 feet tall. He's covered head to toe in this gnarly, like, skeletal horse-shaped armor. That's literally what they were going for, if you watch the special features, is they wanted his mask to look like a skeletal horse face. Because, I guess, they thought that made him look more spooky.
It kind of looks like the dragon armor from Skyrim. A bit like it.
The people who made it said they were trying to make it look like a skeletal horse, so whatever.
No, they did a good job, I think.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't recall there ever... Maybe in the Silmarillion, which I still need to read. But yeah, I don't recall anybody describing how Sauron appeared during the battle and what he wore.
It's one of those things...
looked like in those times, so...
Yeah, I guess
it's always very ambiguous about describing people too much. Mm-hmm. The characters, he wanted to leave it to the imagination, yeah. Which I think is great because he does it so well. Because I used to watch it all the time, I kind of picture them as the animated versions in the old Ralph Bakshi film.
Like, yeah. I was totally not expecting Gollum to look the way that he did, you know, because I was thinking of like this lizardish like creature from. The 70s cartoon.
Yeah.
And we
Which
get...
is really what he's supposed to look like. That's the funny thing is...
We get a humanoid.
Everybody scoffs at is actually the more accurate version. Ralph Bakshi was trying to fit Fellowship and Two Towers into one movie, so everything was really compressed for time. But he got the salient points across. He told the story. I mean, there had to be loose ends because it was 2 out of 3 books. But he stayed faithful to the book, so I always had to appreciate that. And again, we're still straying from the topic. Gollum's stupid Saturday morning cartoon voice, that pretty much says it all. He's supposed to sound pitiful and whiny, not like a fucking a Furby.
Alright,
next line. Have to admit, the movie in general is very pretty and the Shire stuff is wonderful. That's true. Working in snippets from the book's narrative is not a substitute for accuracy. Okay, that's also true. It's an adaptation from a book, so the characters are going to, you know, repeat things, direct lines and stuff, but having characters just spit out whole paragraphs of narrative to explain something, you know, it's a movie, not a book. Show it, don't tell it. Okay. Why are the random side characters more real and believable than the main characters? That was that grumpy old farmer that scowled at Gandalf as he came by.
Yeah. And they play on that again.
And then all the kids come out and he sets off some fireworks to make the kids happy. And he starts cackling despite himself. You know, that was a great character moment. That guy is like the prototypical hobbit.
Yeah, but then like he starts getting into it and his wife like looks at him and he's like, oh yeah.
And he like, oh shit, yeah. He kind of forgot himself for a moment. You know, yeah. That's very hobbit-like. Oh yeah, have to remain prim and proper. Have to keep up appearances for the neighbors.
Yep.
So that was good. And let's see here. The fact that most of the Shire stuff is so close to the book just makes all the later changes that much more of a betrayal. See, this is when I'm about 20 minutes into the movie and I'm already starting to feel the burn. Okay, establishing and reducing Merry and Pippin as a pair of bumbling pranksters. That's them stealing the firework at the birthday party and end up washing dishes as punishment like they're a couple of unruly kids.
But they were, though, right? Weren't they?
No! Merry and Pippin in the book were nothing like that.
Okay, well, consider that, like, I don't know how old they were in the book, but I do know...
In the book, they're both close to or about 30, which is the hobbits coming of age, so they're...
The hobbits coming of age was 33, which... was
yes, I just said that they're both close to around 30 or 33, which they're close to being coming of age.
Okay.
I think Pippin is 29. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he says he's 29 in the book. So they're not irresponsible teenagers or 20-year-olds. You know, they're right. Close to maturity. They're old enough to know better. They know they're on a serious journey. They're not going to fuck around.
Yeah. Well, even considering by the time they go on that journey, technically, because I've read this part of the book. That, what was it, 12 years that had passed?
17 years passed between the party and when Gandalf returns.
So they would have been in...
finally happening.
So they would have been in their 50s.
No.
They would have been in their 50s when they went to head out onto with the Fellowship.
In the book, yes.
Yes.
But even in the book, there was never any reference to Merry and Pippin acting in any way like that.
Okay.
But that's beside the point.
Yeah, well, they should have portrayed this in the movie. With all of them, actually.
Yeah, but that's beside the point. Even if they were kids at Bilbo's party, there was still no reference to this. They're just... This is the movie reinventing characters from the ground up.
All right.
It's like, okay, we need to have comic sidekicks in this big, dumb action movie, so we're just going to take Merry and Pippin and make them a couple of jokesters. Yeah, we're going to have Fred and George Weasley in this movie.
Wicked.
Yeah, next point here. As soon as Bilbo leaves, everything starts going downhill. This is true. This is when the changes in the story shift into high gear. 17 years between Bilbo leaving and Sauron finding about the ring has turned into about 17 minutes. Way to rush the plot. And it's true. The movie, it makes it look like the next night after the party, you know, it's like, really, there is no indication of time passed at all.
It's like the
nobody
difference.
Ever says, Gandalf, you're back. It's been so many years. No, it's just the next day, everything's happening.
Yeah, because it only shows, like, him just perusing a few books at the library, you know. But they do show him, however, like, trailing Gollum, which is how he found out.
No, they don't. No, they show him riding directly to Minas Tirith.
No. They did. Remember, because he was riding and he looks off into Morgoth, not Morgoth, fucking Mordor. You know, when he sees that the fires of Mount Doom are at it.
You can see Mordor as you're approaching Minas Tirith.
Oh.
So he was just stopping and looking and seeing that shit was happening over there.
Okay, you're right. And they never mentioned it in the film like they did in the book that he had spies following Gollum.
There was never any reference in the movie to the hunt for Gollum. Nobody ever mentions that Aragorn went looking for him. Nobody ever mentions that they spent years looking for him. Nobody ever mentions that they finally caught him and took him to the elves in Mirkwood. They never mention that he escaped from the elves in Mirkwood, which is why Legolas was sent to Rivendell. So we're jumping ahead here. Yeah. But yeah, everything just ties into this big clusterfuck of wrong. The ring does not whisper menacingly.
Not like the Horcruxes of Voldemort.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing, really. This is one of the many, many things that people will flat out try to deny that J.K. Rowling ripped off from somebody else. Horcruxes are totally based on the Ring of Power. The Ring of Power is a Horcrux. As long as it exists, Sauron can't die.
I like how we're talking about all this like dark, menacing shit. And right out of the corner of my eye, I could have sworn somebody was in front of the window on the porch. Like I saw a silhouette. Like I'm in.
You did. They're after you.
I'm in shadow. I mentioned Voldemort's name now. The jinx is activated.
You blew it. Okay. It's Frodo who decides to lead the Shire, not Gandalf who tells him to go. This is one of the things that started bothering me right away. In the movie, Gandalf shows up out of fucking nowhere, blitzes Frodo with an exposition dump in about 30 seconds, scares the shit out of him, catches Sam listening outside, and tells them they have to leave the Shire right now. They are rushing the plot. In the book, as I said, Gandalf comes back after 17 years of exploration and hunting Gollum and other things, and he sits down. He arrives in the evening. You know, they talk late into the night. They get some sleep, and the next morning they're having breakfast in the kitchen. Sam's outside cutting the grass, and they're talking all the history of the ring. And this is where Gandalf first finally reveals that he had heard Gollum's story firsthand because he had had Gollum followed and captured, and he had went and spent several days talking with Gollum to get the truth, to find out where he got the ring.
Yeah, he gets into much more detail about how he's found out all this information.
Yes, they talk about the how Sauron lost the ring. They talk about the whole history of the ring up until it came to him.
And
because,
even at, sorry,
because continue. Frodo deserved to know. Then they catch Sam eavesdropping. They swear Sam to secrecy. And in the book, actually, 2 weeks pass from that conversation in which Gandalf was staying at Bag End and Frodo still hadn't made a decision.
Yeah.
Until finally he decides to leave on his and Bilbo's birthday. So he sells Bag End to the Sackville Bagginses and pretends to buy a house in Buckland because it's on the eastern border of the Shire, and that's the way he has to go to leave anyway. So, and since he grew up there as a kid in Buckland, his going back pretending to be running out of money, that's at least a plausible story for why he's leaving Bag End.
And they're trying to keep people from freaking searching the house for money.
Well, no, it's not just that. I mean, he sold it to his cousins, the Sackville Bagginses.
Yeah, those
but
bastards.
This is all part of the plan of leaving the Shire quietly without arousing attention.
Yep. Now,
so he could get to Rivendell and start his journey.
I don't remember too much from the book about the Sackville Bagginses, but in the movie they were like the trailer park versions of hobbits.
Kinda.
I'm imagining just like a wife beater being worn by the male Sackville Baggins, you know.
Well, there was just this silly feud between them and Bilbo because when he went off before with the dwarves and everybody thought he was dead, they thought for sure they were going to get Bag End and they really wanted it because it's such a nice place. And then he came back and he had been declared legally dead, so he had a bunch of legal shit, but they always pretended not to believe it was really him because they still wanted the house.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they're finally so happy to snatch it up when Frodo decides to sell it as a cover for leaving the Shire. But anyway, the departure is rushed, so no Pippin on the journey, because in the book, you know, they set a date for the day after the birthday when the sale is final, and they leave at midnight that night when the sale actually takes place.
Yeah.
So they set out for Buckland on foot, Frodo, Sam, and Pippin, because Merry and another hobbit, their friend Fatty Bulger, had ridden on ahead the day before with the last cartload of Frodo's things to, you know, set things up at the house and get things ready.
Yep.
This was all part of the plan, to walk across the Shire and just enjoy the, you know, what he thought might be the last time he would see it.
Yeah.
That'd be understandable. At the time, he had no hope for the journey at all. and obviously Sam knew, and Pippin knew, although Frodo didn't know that Pippin knew. It was all a conspiracy. So they get chased by the Black Riders, they finally make it to Buckland, they meet Merry after sitting and talking with Farmer Maggot for a while. There was no stealing from Farmer Maggot. They just happened to come across his fields when they would try to take a shortcut through the woods to throw off the chase. So Farmer Maggot gives them a ride in his pony cart to the ferry.
Oh, that's right, and that's where they met up with...
They meet up with Merry. Yep. They cross the ferry. They see a Black Rider on the platform they just left, which thankfully they can't cross after them. So they get to the Frodo's new house in Buckland. They have dinner, and then they sit down to talk. Frodo tries to work up the nerve to tell everybody that he's leaving, and then they say, well, we know you're leaving, and we know about the ring, and we know about everything, and Frodo's just like, duh? Because apparently Sam had been spying on them, and Merry had known about the ring long before Bilbo had left, and he even like snuck a peek at Bilbo's book at one point. So anyway, long story short, the departure from the Shire was extremely rushed. They just, like, Gandalf's like, okay, you guys take the ring, get the hell out now. And on the way, they just bump into Merry and Pippin, and Merry and Pippin just go with them. And that's it.
Okay. The end. Well, now that this rant is over.
Next note. No Farmer Maggot. Everything has degraded into a stupid action movie. There's no atmosphere, no creativity. Everything was changed to make it as easy as possible, and no one has to think or be challenged by anything in the story. This is when I've officially gotten pissed off at the movie.
It sounds it. Like, just you like trying to read your notes, I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, this is what I was feeling at the time watching the movie.
He's about to go Super Saiyan on this.
This is when they're just getting debris. Sauron just appears if Frodo puts on the ring. Bullshit. The ring's not that powerful yet, guys. It's like, still far, far away from Mordor and its master. It's not that powerful.
Yeah.
More powerful than when Frodo had when Bilbo had it.
Well, they did mention that the ring just recently woke up, it had such a quick hold on Bilbo.
The ring doesn't start having an effect on Frodo until they start crossing the Dead Marshes and he's getting close to Mordor. That's a long time before it starts having an effect on him. But this is just them trying to make the ring a character in the movie instead of the plot device. And so they're doing everything in their power to make the ring seem like it's alive and evil.
Yeah, like, okay.
Hence the whispering menacingly. And
they kept talking about how Frodo is holding up such a resilience to the ring, whereas in movie time it's only been, like, less than a week.
I know.
And it's like, well, no freaking duh. I mean, look at Bilbo. He's held the ring for 60 years.
80, really?
Yeah.
No, it was 60 years, but it had been 80 since he had found it. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of a different reference, so yeah, 60. You're right.
But, yeah, but I'm talking about, like, the lack of explanation of, time transition.
Yeah, they're just rushing everything because plot. Okay. No subtlety in Strider's introduction. They just go along with him because he says so. No mention of Gandalf's letter, just more stupid action movie shit. It's true.
Well, the entire book, all they're doing is walk into a volcano. And yeah, so no, simply put
no,
by...
No, no. No.
Hold on. So
I know
they...
what you're doing. Shut up. No. No. Fucking, in the movie, well, in the book, Strider actually speaks to Frodo before Frodo jumps up and puts the ring on. Because he gets up and does a song to distract people when he realizes that Pippin is telling the story of Bilbo's party, and they're trying to avoid, you know, reminding anybody about Bilbo or... you know, the name Baggins or anything to do with them.
Yeah, they're trying to stay low.
So Strider advises Frodo to do something quick to distract him. So Frodo jumps up on a table and starts singing a song, and he slips on a tray of mugs. His hand jerks into his pocket, and that's how he puts the ring on. And then he quickly crawls away and takes it off and tries to pass it off like he was talking to Strider in the corner. Then Strider leans in and says, okay, I know who you are. I know what you've got. We're going to have a talk later on. And then Mr. Butterbur comes over and he asks if he can have a talk with them later on.
Mr. Butterbur, he was the innkeeper.
Yeah, so they go back to the room. They find Strider is already there ahead of them. And he starts telling them about himself. He actually sits down and talks with them and tries to convince them to take him along as a guide. And then Butterbur comes in. He tells them he just remembered, finally, after like 3 months, that Gandalf had left him a letter to be sent to the Shire, but he couldn't find anybody to take it to the Shire, and then he forgot about it.
Interesting.
So Gandalf had left a letter for Frodo, telling him to be on the watch for Aragorn, describing him, telling him the quote, or the poem that Bilbo wrote, you know, all that is gold does not glitter, not all those who wander are lost. That whole thing, that was a poem about Strider that Bilbo wrote for him. So the letter tells them that if he's not back by a certain time, which actually is already passed, that they should leave right away and look for Strider or Aragorn.
Aragorn around these parts. I don't know what his real name is, but they know him as Strider.
Yeah.
Sorry. I really liked that part because it added this like this air of mystery to him, you know,
yeah,
instead of him just coming out right away. I'm Aragorn. Let me tell you my life story tonight.
Well, like, see, here's the fun part about that. You love that line so much because it works so well. That's one of the lines they took from the book. That's pretty much what Butterbur really says. You can recognize the good stuff because that's the stuff that came from the book. So Aragorn shows them the broken sword that he always carries. We discussed this before. You know, he finally convinces them that he really is a friend, that he's there to protect them, that he really is Gandalf's friend. And they decide to spend the night in the parlor instead of going to the rooms because they know Bill Ferny had been watching and saw Frodo disappear. And Black Riders had been passing through Bree before, looking for Baggins. So, you know, obviously Black Riders attack that night and they find Frodo isn't there and they leave. Next here. Merry and Pippin, especially Pippin, are oblivious morons who seem to have nearly no idea where they're going or what's happening. This is true.
They're just going along for the ride because of Frodo and because their friends are there. They're just like, we're just going to tag along. We're bored. Let's go with them.
Yeah, they have the mentality of 5-year-olds. They're so fucking dumb. I mean, that whole scene with the apples when they're first heading out, Pippin's talking about second breakfast and elevenses and afternoon tea and dinner and supper, and Strider throws an apple at him.
Hits him right in the head.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Strider just happens to have 4 hobbit-sized swords. He just leaves them alone when they know the Black Riders are near. That was bullshit. In the book, right after they leave the Shire, they pass through the old forest and meet Tom Bombadil. They spend 2 days at Bombadil because it rains the second day, so they can't leave anyway. The next day, in order to get back to the main road, they have to pass through the Barrow Downs, which are full of evil spirits called Barrow Wights. As they're passing through the downs, a fog comes in, they get lost, and they get trapped in one of the barrows. So they have to sing a special song that Tom Bombadil taught them to sing that would summon him in case they got in trouble before they get back to the road. Frodo sings the song. Bombadil comes busting in like freaking Chuck Norris. He kills the Barrow Wights, takes the hobbits outside, revives Sam, Merry, and Pippin. Then he goes back inside, kills off anything that left that survived the first attack. I'm not even kidding. And then he just hauls out this huge load of treasure that was in there. And out of this treasure, he picks out 4 daggers that were made by the men of Numenor and Western Ess in the early days, because the Barrow Downs were the graves of the old kings, of the old people. No, back in like the Second Age, when the Witch King of Angmar was wreaking hell up in the north. So all the Barrow Wights are actually reanimated corpses of the old Numenorians, or the last Numenorians. So the hobbits have actually really, really nice swords. These are work of Numenor. this is good shit. That's why in Return of the King, when Merry and Eowyn are fighting the Witch King,
yep,
and Merry stabs him with his sword, that sword was made by the folk of Western Ness, and it was made was made especially for the purpose of fighting the Nazgul. No other weapon in the world, no matter who was using it, could have done so much damage to the Witch King, allowing Eowyn to kill it. In the movie, Strider just has these things bundled up and is like, here, have some swords. I'm going to leave you now.
Have some of these generic no-name swords. Here you go.
Yeah, here's just some random shit I just happen to have bundled up.
You don't know how they use him yet, but...
Yeah, in case I ever end up traveling with four hobbits, here's these swords I just happen to have. In the book, when they get to Weathertop, they climb up, they see that the whole top of the hill has been blackened by fire, and they find a rock that has the G rune and the number 3 scratched on it, indicating that Gandalf was there on October the 3rd, 3 days before they arrived. In the book, when they're passing the Midgewater Marshes, they see the sky flickering at night. And that's actually them seeing Gandalf fighting off the Black Riders. So at that point, they know that Gandalf has gone ahead of them and they can't wait for him any longer. But night is falling, and while they're on top of the hill, they see some of the Black Riders on the road. So they take shelter in the dell. Aragorn builds a fire, and he, you know, stays there to tell them stories to help them drive away the fear. So yep. Aragorn does not leave the hobbits.
Okay, but the
go ahead.
All right. But the fire doesn't like attract the riders
they,
at all.
They talk about that. You know, Aragorn's like, they find a hollow dell where other rangers had been previously, and they find a store of firewood laid by. Cool. So Aragorn says, we'll take this as a sign, and we'll use this firewood. You know, fire is our protection. And Sam says, yeah, and it's also as good a way of saying, here we are, as opposed to shouting. But they build a fire, because, you know, they need something.
Yeah.
And Aragorn stays there to protect them and tell them stories. And he tells them some of the story about the Lúthien to Núvil. But the idea that Strider would just leave them alone.
Yeah, that, okay, I was thinking about that while you were mentioning about what happened in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking, like, well, he is a ranger, though. Wasn't he just, like, he just ran off the scout ahead just to...
No, he would not leave them because they are completely defenseless, and he knows they're being followed.
Well, I figured that, you know, and in which case, if he was, like, going to take off just to, you know, scout ahead, that they wouldn't be stupid enough to start a fire to give away their position.
Another good point, the fact that they would be that stupid.
Yeah.
But no, in the book, the hollow dell is kind of sheltered. It's not up on the side of the hill where anybody could see it.
All right.
And they would want the fire because it would offer them some protection from the Black Riders, too.
So
as showed in the book, at least, when the Black Riders appear and Frodo puts on the ring, in the book, Frodo tries to fight him.
As opposed to just falling back and yelling?
Yeah. In the book, Frodo is actually worth something. In the movie, Frodo was a worthless sack of shit. He's completely incompetent and completely incapable of making a decision for himself.
I don't want to admit that. Like, I watched it, I was just like, why isn't Frodo doing anything?
Frodo never does a fucking... The few times he ever does anything, it takes you completely by surprise.
Yeah, like, just thinking on, like, ahead in the other movies, I'm just like, he's just letting Sam do everything for him, you know?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm thinking, what else is Sam going to do for him? Like, oh my god, wipe his ass and blow his nose and...
Just about, in the book, when Gandalf tells Frodo what the ring is and what it's capable of, Frodo, almost on the spot, says, well, I guess I got to get rid of it. I guess I got to take it away.
Yeah, like, it makes sense.
To protect the Shire. I got to take it away. Yeah. It makes a decision. I have to take it away to protect the Shire. So not only is he doing something courageous.
What do I do, Gandalf? I can't make this decision on my own, Gandalf.
Yeah, I'm completely stupid and worthless.
I know the obvious answer is to get rid of it, but what do I do with this?
It's like they could have had a movie where they the Fellowship carrying along a cardboard cut out of Frodo with the ring duct taped to it. Come on, Frodo. We're going to Mordor. Whose turn is to carry him now? That's what he's been reduced to. He is so completely useless.
Pretty much anybody could just carry that damn
ring.
Case
in point, the next note. Frodo goes all to pieces after getting stabbed instead of resisting the evil. In the book, I think it's like 17 days from when Frodo is stabbed to when they finally get to Rivendell. And apart from being in a lot of pain and suffering chills, Frodo is still pretty much himself. He's really weak, so he can't walk. So they have him riding the pony most of the time.
Yep.
But he's not just, you know, rolling around and wheezing and
turned into a Nazgul, like, dramatically.
Yeah, he's not, like, frothing at the mouth. And
his eyes don't turn to the Walking Dead, like...
No, when
it's
they
like he's
find,
a zombie.
When they find the trolls, it's daytime, first of all. And Frodo is actually feeling pretty good at the time. Because it's a reminder of Bilbo's first successful adventure. And it uplifts his spirits. See,
he's like, I'm following the same footsteps as my Uncle Bilbo.
Yeah, things are going not so bad right now.
I'm still alive.
I'm just saying, in the book, Frodo has deep down tough. And he is resisting the evil of the splinter that would otherwise have overcome anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Which is why in the spoof that we're hypothetically going to do, that when we do have the cardboard cut out of Frodo, we'll have it wear the ring because the cardboard cutout is not organic. Well, it is organic, like in the fact that it's from, you know, once living material, but it is not going to be. We're just going to hold its hand and carry it around, and we don't have to touch the ring at all.
Yeah. Again, it is not until they're at the Ford of Bruinen and the Black Riders are after them. It's not until that time that the ring, the sliver, I should say, of the knife. It's not until that time that it finally starts overcoming him because he's so weak and he's so tired and the Black Riders are so near and they're fucking with him. So it came down to the wire. Okay. But the fact remains that Frodo was fighting it really hard. In the movie, nothing.
Arwen just like takes him and just starts
running
up.
Oh yeah, that's my next line. All Uh-oh. Caps. Fucking Arwen! Elrond would never let his only daughter ride around in the wild with a Nazgul known to be abroad. This is completely true. first of all, Arwen is a lady. She's not an adventurer. She's not fucking Xena. She's not going to ride around wearing a sword and challenging the Black Riders. Okay?
She's just there for
that would never happen. No.
Sex appeal.
Elrond would never let that happen. She would never be out there. In the book, they meet an elf named Glorfindel, who was one of Elrond's folk. And he is actually one of the survivors. No, that was somebody else. Oh, no, wait, that was changed again. But Glorfindel is actually a very important elf because he's the one who long ago prophesied the Witch King could not be killed by the hand of man.
As, I guess, the one shining brilliant moment that Frodo had in the book, in the movie, was he figures out it's a riddle.
And that wasn't even him in the book.
It's a play on words.
Frodo had nothing to do with that in the book.
It was
Mary.
I think anyway, I actually read ahead. That part. Yeah.
Okay, but. Next line. Why is Frodo even in this movie?
Oh, here we go.
Oh, Jesus. I already made this joke, forgetting that I already wrote it down. The rest of the cast could just carry around a cardboard cutout of him and it would amount to the same thing. I forgot I had written that.
If we were to like make like a spoof of the movie, it'd be a cardboard cutout somehow taking like the boat out into the water.
Yep.
It makes it to the eastern shore. You just see like Sam just dragging the cardboard cutout.
Shake it off. It's got water on it.
And then the trio's just like, let's go hunt some work. There goes the life-size Frodo.
Don't worry, I got a spare folded up in my backpack. Most elves, especially the very wise ones like Elrond, are above bigotry and scorn. Elrond in the movie has nothing good to say about anybody other than elves. He looks down upon dwarves. He flat out says, men are weak. Men are useless. Men are no good for us.
He's racist.
Yeah. He is racist as fuck.
yet he combines or he like calls everybody in for a council.
Again, he doesn't do that. Again, remember in the other one we did, the other Zotcast, we were talking about, I had talked about how all the people who were at the council, most of them were Elrond's folk who were already there anyway. There was a messenger from Curdan at the Havens.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what he was doing there. Legolas was there to tell them about Gollum escaping. Gimli and his father Glóin were there to tell them about the messenger from Mordor. Boromir had been sent there by his father to discover the meaning of the dreams. So yeah, everybody had a reason for being there. Next line. Gimli is a complete idiot. And besides being a badass in battle, he's been reduced to a joke.
A short joke.
Pretty much, yeah.
And the joke about that one joke about his beard when they were running through the Mine of Moria.
During the Council of Elrond, when he tries to break the ring with his axe like a friggin' dumbass.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Frodo holds it up once when called upon to do so. Then he puts it away again. He doesn't even on a little pedestal in the middle of the room where everybody is stare at get fucked up by. And Gimli would not bear an axe into a council of the wise.
Don't bring in your weapon. It's a peaceful, like...
No, the guy is like friggin' 120, 130 years old. He knows what he's doing. He's not an idiot. The council breaks down into a huge argument when these are supposed to be the wisest people they could gather in haste. Wise people don't resort to loud arguments. It's true. In the book, everybody sits there quietly trying to think of what the fuck they're supposed to do.
Which is like completely opposite of what you see, like, you know, in our government.
No, but in the movie, like, they can't decide what to do within 5 seconds, so they all leap to their feet and start arguing like a bunch of old bitches. In the book, they talk about everything, and then finally they come up to a dead end, like, okay, we can't send it over the sea. We can't ask Bombadil to take it and keep it safe, because apparently it has no power over him. You know, we can't keep it here. We can't keep it from Sauron forever. Somebody has to destroy it. Who and how? And so then they all just sit there quietly trying to figure this out. And then Frodo surprises himself by standing up and saying, I will take the ring, though I do not know the way. So, you know, that's the end of the council. Okay, here's my Aragorn thing. Aragorn should have no reluctance about going on the quest. He has everything to gain. Next note. Aragorn's sword must be discussed. Yeah.
Are we talking about Isildur's original sword, or are we talking about...
Yes, the Shards of Narsil.
Okay.
Yes, the sword that he was supposed to have with him all the time. Although they never did explain what he did with it, other than carrying it in the book. Because in the book, he'd obviously been an adventurer for years. They don't talk about him carrying any other sword. The sword of Isildur is broken about a foot from the hilt, so I guess he has a short sword. There's never any mention of him having a quiver of arrows or anything. We're just supposed to assume that he's spent all these years adventuring and, you know, battling evil with a broken sword.
Yeah. Well, they did mention that he turned from his past. Like,
what? No.
Elrond said that he turned from...
No.
You from his fate.
Cannot take anything the movie says as having anything to do with anything.
Okay.
If one has taken the time to read the appendices, there is a kind of a short summary of the history of Aragorn and Arwen. It talks about how when Aragorn was a young man and came of age, Elrond took him aside and told him his true heritage. As a child, Aragorn grew up in Rivendell as Elrond's foster son because his parents were dead. And when he came of age, Elrond said, "Okay, you are actually the heir of Isildur. You are destined to become the king of the Gondor and Arnor in the north when the time comes. Until then, you must go forth." And he basically sends him out to explore the world, and that's when Aragorn becomes a ranger. That's when he finally realizes who he is and that he has a destiny, and he embraces this right away. He has the nobility of the Son of Kings. He's not arrogant about this. He sees it as the path that he's supposed to take, so he takes it. After he's been traveling for a while, he finally makes his way to Lothlorien, and that's where he meets Arwen, and after a very short time, they fall in love and pledge to marry each other. And eventually, Arwen finds out about this and tells Aragorn that no man less than the King of Gondor can marry my daughter. So now Aragorn has another reason to want to become king. He has two very good reasons. It's his right to become the king, and he has to become the king to marry his one true love. In the movie, he doesn't want to become the king because. And that's it.
Well, it was explained in the movie that he was afraid that he would have the same weakness as Isildur and he would fall under the power
bullshit.
Of the
wind. Made up bullshit. Thank you, Peter Jackson. Aragorn has no fear of embracing his destiny. And as I mentioned before, not once does he show any temptation of the ring, or does he show any indication of being tempted by the ring. He is a true-blooded Numenorean. He is better than that. And also, he's basically better than his ancestors. Okay. Implying Saruman had anything to do with the storm on Caradhras. Saruman did not have anything to do with that storm. It was implied to actually be the mountain itself, which has no love of elves. Oh no, it has no love of dwarves, apparently. It doesn't like dwarves. So the mountain itself was supposed to have been making the storm to daunt them from trying to cross the pass.
Because Gimli.
Kinda, yeah. Reversing Gandalf's opinion of Moria. In the book, Gandalf was pushing really hard. Well, not like that, but he was strongly suggesting that they should probably have to go through Moria to shake off pursuit. And Aragorn is like, no, not a good idea. But after the Pass of Caradhras fails, they have to go to Moria, as Gandalf suspected they would all along. So, there is no reason why Gandalf wouldn't choose to go this way. The real Gandalf, because he would know the danger of taking the hobbits too close to Isengard, which is where the Gap Rohan is. Mm-hmm. They would have to cross the mountains there because there's no other place they could cross it to get to Lothlorien in the straighter road towards Mordor. Okay.
That makes me wonder, though, how... Well, I mean, yeah, he's Gandalf, but how he would know about the Balrog being in that area, in that place. You know what I mean? Like, okay, like he acts like he's been there before, yet he's completely surprised when all the dwarves are dead.
Both Gandalf and Aragorn had both gone through Moria once before, but for both of them, it was a long time ago, and Aragorn was against going back, and Gandalf obviously wasn't happy about it either. But, you know, running out of options, that was what he saw as the lesser of two evils. He knew there was a chance they might run into orcs, but he knew there was a chance they might also run into Balin and his dwarves that had gone there 30 years ago. Obviously, they didn't.
Right. Now, it's been a while, but wasn't Balin part of the original, like,
band? Yep, Balin was one of the Thorin's 13 companions.
Okay. Cool. Well, that sucks.
He also took Olwen and Glóin, I think.
Oh, man.
Or was it Ori and Nori?
I don't know about Ori and
Nori. I know he took Ori. Anyway.
It kind of makes you wonder, though. It's like, just hearing about it, it's like, after watching it, it's like, oh my god, almost like everybody in the original 14 have died. You know, like the 14 dwarves that went to go to the Misty Mountains, to the Misty Mountains, go to the Lonely Mountain to retrieve their lost, forgotten gold.
Oh, actually, in Lord of the Rings, after Frodo recovers in Rivendell, he meets Glowin at the feast. And so they talk for a long time during the feast, and they catch up on events. And, you know, Glowin tells him about all the other survivors, and there were still quite a few of them. So, you know, they did all right.
Cool. Not everybody died because of the ring.
These movies have a bad habit of transplanting conversations to other parts of the story where their context is questionable. In Moria, Frodo and Gandalf sit down and they have the talk about Gollum, and they have the talk about Frodo saying that he wished Bilbo had killed him and Gandalf admonishing him for that. That conversation was supposed to take place back in Bag End.
Yeah, I was going to say, didn't
on the same day that Gandalf told Frodo about the ring.
That felt like it was supposed to have happened early on.
And in fact, Gollum follows them all through Moria. And although the narrative only ever implies that Frodo has become aware of it, and not until much later, when Gollum is following them down the river, does Aragorn wake up and find Frodo standing holding a sword after an appearance by Gollum. And Aragorn reveals that he was aware of Gollum in Moria, and he had been trying to catch him. He had tried several times to catch him, but couldn't.
He's a wily little river folk.
Yeah.
Or whoever the hell he is.
Yeah. In the book, they talk about Gollum's people as the fathers of the fathers of the Stoors, which is one of the primary breeds of Hobbit at the time the story is taking place. So they're just ancestors of Hobbits from about 500 years prior, back when they used to live in the vales of the River Anduin near Rohan. Anyway, Frodo only ever attacks with his sword once against the cave troll. Never again. He's completely useless. That's true. He swings at the troll one time. He never uses that sword for anything again.
Whereas the other time he's just playing like peekaboo with a guy behind a pillar.
Yeah, I mean, he draws the sword plenty of other times because we gotta show it off, but he never actually uses it again. In the book, Frodo did his fair share of fighting. Before they got to Moria, they were attacked by wolves at night, and they all had to defend themselves there. Frodo had to defend himself when they were attacked by Balin's tomb. Frodo, he didn't fight much, but he did fight more than once at least.
Or at least it seemed that way in the book.
Yeah. It's implied that he was involved and he was doing his share. It just wasn't drawing attention to the fact that, and Frodo slew this orc, and, you know, Sam thrust over here and all the shit, you know.
Frodo was drinking the Bombadil juice.
Yeah, right.
Chuck Norris his way through the mind
again,
of Moria.
I don't blame Elijah Wood. It's the direction he was given and the script he was given. But Frodo in the movies is a complete jellyfish. There is absolutely nothing to him. He's not interesting. He's not special. He's just a meat puppet to carry the ring.
He's a flesh and blood cardboard cutout of Frodo.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is what kind of, I started thinking about this, because I remember watching some extras, that Ian McKellen, Sir Ian McKellen, you know, acting legacy, right, he loves the book so much that when he read the script, wouldn't you think that he'd put up a little bit of a fight and be like, what the hell is going on here? Because in some of the extra features that I remember seeing, he was like, he was telling all the other actors, he's like, okay, this is what you gotta do, because this is what happened in the book, even though, like, I mean, different interactions between the characters, even though it was in the different context of the movie.
Uh-huh. And that's the thing, too, is the fact that even the people on the set were calling out the fact that they were changing shit, doing it wrong.
And like
when your actor playing Gandalf is saying, no, it's not like this. Look at the book. You know you're doing something wrong with your movie.
You know it's bad when you have the actors, the actual, like an actor giving you direction.
Okay. No complaints about the Moria part in general. There's not much else they could have done besides follow the book. Except the part with the breaking stairway. That was more dumb action movie shit. And it was. That didn't need to be there. There was never any reference to it.
It could have happened. Never read the... Like I said, I never got to that part in the book.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, you could assume that could have happened.
No, it didn't happen.
But physics.
No. There was never any mention of a freaking crumbling stairway. They were going down a stairway that was carved through rock. It was a tunnel, not an exposed stairway out in the middle of fucking vast empty space. Like the dwarves had time to hollow out the entire fucking mountain. Okay, jumping forward a little bit now to Lorien. So I'm running out of notes here. Things were kind of winding down at this point. The movies have a general disdain of Sam and always leave him out of important scenes where he should be involved. This, of course, is referring to the Mirror of Galadriel. Frodo never goes anywhere that Sam does not follow him. Sam wakes up. On more than one occasion, Sam will wake up out of a sound sleep to find that Frodo has left his side, at which point he will immediately get up and follow.
Because he was told to.
No, because he is so loyal to Frodo and he loves him like a true friend.
And because Gandalf told him not to leave his side.
Actually, no, that wasn't Gandalf. That was elves that they met in the Shire after leaving Bag End.
That's right. Okay. Hold on. In the extended version, they were... Remember when they were, like, getting...
Elves.
Yes. I'm like, no, aren't those supposed to be the elves that they were supposed to, like, sit and like, picnic with?
Well, yeah. In the book, after their second encounter with the Black Rider at night, the Black Rider is scared away by the sound of elves singing. And shortly, a group of elves come by, you know, just singing because that's what elves do. They like to sing.
Yeah.
And they find the hobbits, and they realize that something's up, and they take them with them for a while. They have dinner that night, and they talk. And the next morning, the elves have gone, but they'll spread the messages throughout the lands that there are hobbits on the way to Rivendell in need of help. And it was one of these elves talking to Sam that night that told him not to leave Frodo, because it was obvious to them that Frodo was leaving the Shire with some kind of heavy burden, but they didn't know exactly what, because elves are incredibly smart like that.
They're intuitive.
Exactly.
They've got empathy.
Okay.
Move it along.
Sauron is showed too many times, and he's made to look menacing but impotent. This is true. In the book, everybody talks about Sauron all the time, but he never appears as an actual character. He's only ever talked about. In the movie, we see him all the fucking time, and all he does is just be a giant flaming eye on top of his tower. All he does is just sit there on top of his tower and order everybody around. In the book, he's kept in secret. You never see him, you never see a description of him, he never speaks to anybody directly, no one ever speaks to him directly. But he is the primary force of all evil in the world at the time.
Yeah,
being servant of Melkor.
And if anybody, like, knows, like...
Morgoth, yeah.
Some similarities in, like, you know, name spelling, Sauron, Saruman, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just... Yeah, Sauron, Sauron. Or
I'm saying, what's your point again?
Is that nobody would, you know, nobody in fiction would ever figure this out, put two and two together, you know, and be like, well, I don't know. Kind of like, what do you think of, like, Sinestro from the Green Lantern?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like Sinister is part of the name.
Yeah.
You know, and...
No, Saruman's name and Sauron's name, while similar, have no connection otherwise.
I would have been wary about that.
Well, that's something they did in the Bakshi film, is maybe the producers thought that having two enemies with the same name starting with an S would be confusing. So in the Bakshi film, after the first couple of times of saying Saruman's name, they start calling him Aruman. So in the Bakshi film, it's Sauron and Aruman, so as not to confuse people too much.
And moving along, sorry.
Nope, it's fine. Okay, Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli did no fighting on Amon-Hen, but they had to make another dumb action movie scene. Yes. In the book, only Boromir finds orcs after he was sent after Merry and Pippin, when they all ran off to find Frodo. Boromir blows his horn, he fights the orcs, he gets shot a lot, and the hobbits get taken prisoner. And then Aragorn comes up after, finds Boromir dying, hears his last words, and doesn't ask him till he's too late if he found Frodo and Sam. So then Legolas and Gimli finally get there. They have a funeral for Boromir where they put him in a boat. Well, they figure out that one of the boats is missing and Frodo and Sam are gone. So they have to choose between following Frodo and Sam or going to rescue Merry and Pippin. So finally they decide to rescue Merry and Pippin. Aragorn has already sworn to Boromir to go to Gondor, and obviously it wouldn't be right to just abandon the hobbits to torture and death.
Yeah. Sorry, when I was thinking about it, I'm like, well, yeah, that kind of makes sense, because they could always catch up to, like, once, you know, if they were to get the other two hobbits, they could just catch up with Frodo and Sam anyway.
Well, no, it'd be way too late by then. So, either way, the whole action sequence with Aragorn, you know, fighting the orc and throwing his knife at it and chopping his head off, that never happened. That was just big, dumb action movie shit. Because otherwise the movie just ends with somebody dying and people running off.
I suppose they put that in there to make it more like because they decided to have Aragorn be like afraid of his destiny. So then they have him freaking fighting valiantly in front of a dying Boromir. Boromir, you know, decides to call him his king as his last dying breath.
No. No. I wish it was that way, but no.
Okay.
They just wanted to throw another action sequence in there so people could be excited for at the end. Like, okay, there was a resolution at the end. The big bad orc that we've been fighting this whole time has finally been killed by the hero, and now we're ready for the next part.
Yeah.
None of that fighting happened. Merry and Pippin have to tell Frodo to go because he's too worthless to make the decision himself. Again, this is true. In the book, after running away from putting on the ring and running from Boromir, Frodo goes to the top of the hill. He sits in the seat of the seat of seeing, and he looks at Minas Tirith far away. He looks to the north and sees flames in the border of Lothlorien. He looks east and he sees Mordor. And then he looks at the Black Tower, and Sauron becomes aware of him. And he has just a second between when Sauron finds him, when he hears actually the voice of Gandalf in his mind telling him, "Take it off, you fool, take it off!" So at the last second, Frodo takes off the ring and Sauron misses him. And that's when he finally decides that he has to leave on his own, because the ring is already affecting Boromir, and he doesn't want to affect anybody else. And he doesn't want to lead anybody else to Mordor to die with him.
So that makes more sense.
So he puts the ring back on, and he runs back down to the shore of the river, and he gets ready to leave. But Sam guessed all this and came after him. And what they show in the movie is pretty much what happens in the book. Sam jumps to the boat, misses, goes under, and Frodo has to, you know, grab him by the hair and pull him up and bring him back to shore. And then they decide to leave together.
The reluctant hero. Or like I must go on my own. I don't want anyone following me. But I was sent to help you. I don't care.
Well, it's not. He wasn't sent to help him. It's the fact that I'm not leaving you. I'm going to Mordor. Of course you are, sir, and I'm going with you. Or none of us is going. I'll knock holes in all the boats first. That's a direct quote. Sam is not letting Frodo go alone. And my final note here, which is what I already talked about, Boromir's last stand is cheapened by Aragorn showing up for a fight that never happened. And again, this robs Boromir's final stand of everything it should have been. You know, he went down fighting. Instead, he was rescued at the last second, only to die anyway.
Well, that's Sean Bean for you.
I know. I mean, the character was going to die anyway, but just shoehorning another action sequence in there is just... just more jangling your keys in front of a baby to distract it from being bored.
Sean Bean, the Hilary Swank of the fantasy film.
The professional I will die in your movie guy.
It's like, I got nothing to do for the next couple of years until the next big project. Hey, you got... Hey, anybody... Hey, I'll take on your project. Does anybody die in it? I'll be that guy. Oh, it's a woman?
I am so in.
Oh, it's a woman, huh? Well, hold on. Let me call up Hilary Swank.
Like, what's that? I die? Do it. Well, that concludes part one of Rant of the Rings.
I think for a film, it flowed a little bit too smoothly, whereas they kind of left out some information that could have been useful or at least, you know, enriching to the actual story itself.
Yeah, there's just too many scenes that they made up out of nothing. Like the whole conversation with Elrond and Gandalf and Rivendell before the council. That conversation never happened. Frodo wakes up after being injured. They have a feast that night. They have the council the next morning. There was no time, well maybe there was, but it wasn't in the book, for Gandalf and Elrond to sit down and talk about this, and Elrond to say, no, fuck men, fuck dwarves. None of that was there.
and no Tom Bombadil in the movie.
I can forgive leaving out Tom Bombadil.
But you
really
said he's
can.
Like the Chuck Norris, man. He comes in and like kicks all kinds of ass. I want to see that. And who is Tom Bombadil anyway? Wasn't he like a hobbit or a man? No. Or
nobody's sure what he is. I like...
He's like Beorn?
Well, no.
From The Hobbit?
In one of the episodes of Voice of Middle-earth, Fred talks about the Green Man and the correlation between the Green Man and Bombadil. And I think it's that. I think Bombadil was Tolkien's reference to the existence of the Green Man, the physical manifestation of nature itself as a person.
Okay.
That's why he is the master. He remembers being there before the first drop of rain, before the sun and the moon. He was there before the elves arrived, and the elves were the firstborn. He was there before Melkor came from outside and troubled the world with evil at the beginning of time. Wow. Bombadil was the first, and he will most likely be the last.
Then why can't they just have him, have him help them out on their quest to get rid of...
They talk about that at the council in the book. See, in the Bombadil chapter, he questions Frodo about the ring. He seems to just know everything, or intuit everything, or he asks questions of Frodo that are so cunning and well-worded that Frodo finds himself answering things with more accuracy than he never explained things to Gandalf or Bilbo or even himself. And in the middle of all this talk, Bombadil says, "Show me the ring." And Frodo just whips it out and hands it over without a moment's hesitation, when he couldn't even do that with Gandalf a couple of months before. That's the power of Bombadil. So Frodo hands over the ring. Bombadil immediately puts it on his pinky and holds it up, and he doesn't vanish. The ring has no power over him whatsoever. It will change its size to fit his finger, because that is one of the powers it has.
Yep.
Is that it will randomly expand or shrink.
They did show that in the movie, however.
Yeah, but in the book, Frodo mentions that in Bilbo's last letter, he warned Frodo that the ring would sometimes change its size. So Frodo always kept it clasped to a chain and tucked into a pocket. He didn't have it put on into a necklace until after he woke up in Rivendell and found that somebody had put it on a new chain for him that was light but strong.
It was like a mithril chain or something like that.
It was just an elven necklace that was tougher than whatever he had before, and it was around his neck now, where it'd be harder to lose, I suppose.
Okay. All right.
As opposed to being attached to his pants, where it could get caught on something and ripped off, and he would notice.
Well, he would probably feel like the weight off his shoulders. Like, hold on a second, I'm feeling a little lighter.
Oh, the rings would be a burden to him no matter where he had it. Hmm. In the book, there's actually one part where Frodo, before they get to the gates of Mordor, they've just finished crossing the marshes, and Frodo was just completely exhausted from the weight of it. And he lies down to rest, hoping that by lying down, the weight will be lessened, but it's still on him. So even when he's lying down, he still feels the weight of it.
Wow.
That's how fucking evil it was. Again, like I said before, I could just go on for hours like this, but we're coming up on shit hour and 43 minutes.
Something like that.
You're gonna have to trim this down a bit, but I hope this has been entertaining for somebody. I hope. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I liked the movie. It was visually stunning.
I will always admit the movie looks good. It mm-hmm. looks really good.
But on paper, it looked better.
The actors look really good. The costumes are really good. The swords and the props and the horses and the buildings and everything in it looks good.
Mm-hmm.
But looks aren't everything. It's the old saying, you could polish a turd, but it's still just a polished turd.
We leave it at that, folks. Until the next one, I'm Steve.
Until the next time, I'm Frank. Yep. Hopefully next time my sister Allie will be willing to participate.
Yep.
We'll have a little more input on this and maybe a little more interesting, because the next movie, that's when I started really getting pissed. I mean, I got through the first one all right. I wasn't happy about it, but I got through it in one sitting. The second movie, I didn't watch it all in one sitting, but I did finish it in a day. The third one, as I mentioned once before, I got about 26 minutes, and then I had to stop. And I didn't come back to it for 3 days.
I remember that. I was like, oh my god. I was like, he was really, really, like, he was upset so much. It was like Chinese water torture to a man, because it was like, don't make me watch it, Steve, come on, please, no.
Every passing moment was like I just wanted to beat my head out with something hard. That didn't even make sense, but that's how bad it was. I wanted to do something that didn't make any sense, because it was so bad.
Well, Peter Jackson did it.
Yeah, but fucking 3 days later, I finally sat down and said, okay, I have to finish this shit. I have to do this. I have to get it over with. And I did it. And I was gritting my teeth the whole damn time. Because the fury was unimaginable.
Until next time, guys. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, good night.